Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, Alarmy. Before we get started, we wanted to make sure you heard the big news. The Alarmist has joined Patreon. Patreon subscribers will get access to our content ad-free, as well as our Aftermath post-interview discussion and final verdict. We'll also be putting out additional bonus episodes and other fun stuff. Here's a preview of Guest Alarmist, where I step aside and let a guest walk us through a personal tragedy, and together the Alarmist crew figures out who's to blame. This month, Leah Poliott discusses the sisterhood of the traveling disaster.
But I do want to say, it's like what always happens too is that like you have these like, you know, destinations you want to go to, but then something always happens along the way. There's always magic involved.
Yeah, it's the magic.
What's such the bummer is that Leah and Sarah didn't get to kind of find those pockets of magic in their...
Well, did you? We don't know. Was there a magical moment, even though all this chaos was going on, that you guys think about, like, with fond memories?
There were some ravioli that we had when we first got into France.
That's great.
And that is still magical in my heart.
Great.
It was the only place open from before dinner. We got in. It was like 3 or 4 at a weird time. Nobody was at this restaurant. Best ravioli I've ever had in my entire life.
Oh,
that's
I'm
great.
I'm so happy for you.
Yeah.
Go to patreon.com/thealarmist and subscribe today. Now, on to our episode. Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today we're speaking with guest expert, Captain Scott Miller. Scott is an aviation lecturer at San Jose State University. Scott is also a certified flight instructor at the CFI Flight School in Sacramento, as well as a pilot for a major U.S. airline. Let's hear what he has to say about Malaysian Airlines Flight 370. Hi Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So how long have you been in the aviation industry and what sparked your interest in it?
Well, I was one of those kids when I was 5 or 6 years old, after taking a family trip to my dad's birthplace in Iowa from Sacramento, I realized flying airplanes is what I wanted to do. And I was very fortunate. As soon as I graduated high school, started taking private pilot lessons at the local airport in Sacramento when I was 18, got my private pilot certificate, and never really looked back.
So I'd like to start off by talking about the Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 and you know, how it was a normal flight. It was March 8th, 2014. Flight 370 takes off from Kuala Lumpur shortly after 12:30 a.m. And from all accounts, it was a pretty normal takeoff. Can you walk us through it?
Yeah, there was nothing unusual about any of the pre-flight preparations or the aircraft was loaded. They boarded passengers, cargo, fuel, I'm sure some meals as well. Pushed back from the gate, I believe it was a little bit early even, and taxied out, took off into the night sky, and carried on with its programmed route of flight. Nothing at all to indicate that there would be any anomalies coming up in the flight.
And from your experience, based on what we know now, when do things sort of take a turn? What suddenly becomes unusual during this flight?
When they, as they're progressing across up north through the various air traffic control agencies, they were talking to Singapore Air Traffic Control. They got to the boundary between Singapore and Ho Chi Minh Control, the southern control area that Vietnam operates. They were given a routine handoff, as we call it, told to contact the Ho Chi Minh controller's frequency. And they said, we'll go, goodbye. And no contact was ever made again with the aircraft. So that basically it went from completely normal to a very unusual and tragic situation, literally in the blink of an eye.
And there seemed to be some confusion between air traffic controllers around 1:19 a.m. That's when the final message or the final goodbye was heard. What is it, and why are the different? Why were the different government agencies very slow to communicate?
I think part of it was not so much the late hour itself. I'm sure that that played a small role in it, just because, like any organization at night, you know, things are a little more quiet, a little more mellow, not quite the full staff that you might see during the middle of the day. And I think there might have been a little bit of complacency, because it was up to that point, it had been such a routine exchange and a routine flight. It's, believe it or not, it's not uncommon for aircraft to maybe not be in communication for short periods of time, you know, maybe 30 seconds to a minute, or even a couple of minutes, particularly on a handover like that. So the Vietnamese controllers knew that the aircraft was coming, but when it didn't, because there's some coordination that happens between the air traffic control facilities before the instruction is given to the aircraft to contact the new controller. Basically, the controller that's handing the airplane off sends a message to the new controller saying, hey, here comes an airplane your way. That controller accepts control. When that occurs, that's when the controller handing the airplane off notifies the airplane to contact new control. So that obviously occurred. And so the controller was waiting for it. But again, as I mentioned, you know, a couple minute delay is not, it's not every flight, but it's not unusual. And then all of a sudden, though, I'm sure it dawned on somebody, wait a minute, we haven't heard from Malaysia 370. First thing they did was look at the radar screen to see where the aircraft was on the radar display, and it wasn't there.
And what is the standard protocol then for reporting an unresponsive aircraft, and how did that compare to what actually happened?
Yeah, there does seem to appear to be some delay on that. The first thing that should have happened was some transmissions on the frequency from the controller looking for the airplane. I imagine that occurred. The Vietnamese, I believe, were a little reticent to release a whole lot of information, at least into the general public. Then they would contact the controller where they received the airplane and said, hey, we still haven't talked to them. Are you talking to them or what's happening here? And then at that point, there are additional notifications that would be made to other surrounding air traffic control facilities, all in an attempt to try to locate this airplane. It does appear that all of that occurred, but there appears also to have been a little bit of a delay in starting those protocols.
And what happens? There's no sign of this flight. And eventually, when the flight doesn't arrive at its destination at the time that it's supposed to arrive, what happens then? Who spearheads the search and rescue, and how misguided is it at the very start?
Well, the assumption was made, and a perfectly reasonable and valid assumption, that the aircraft experienced some sort of catastrophic event at that point, right when they received the handoff to Ho Chi Minh Control, and it went down in the sea right there. Logic and common sense led us all to believe that, because everything is normal, everything is fine, and then suddenly they're no longer anywhere, and the assumption was that they went right down into the water right there at that point. The Vietnamese notified all the appropriate people. A search and rescue operation was started. The sun came up, and there was not a trace of the airplane in the area where they expected it to see. And that was highly unusual, that because they knew, you know, exactly where that point was, where that aircraft was, where it should have been in the water there, and there was absolutely no trace of it.
What new information comes into the investigation that shifts not just the location of the search of for the plane, but the theories about what happened to it?
So initially, and this goes to how the radar systems work, and I'm sure you've heard talk of a device called a transponder. So a transponder is a device inside an airplane that transmits a coded pulse unique to that specific flight. We get a transponder code, a four-digit code, as part of our initial air traffic control clearance. We dial in that four-digit code into our transponder, and now as we fly along, when a radar beam hits the airplane, that radar reflected energy goes back to the radar site, but also the coded messages from the airplane. With that specific transponder code, and then the air traffic control computer recognizes that as, in this case, Malaysia 370, and puts a little tag on the radar screen that the controller can see. There's a number of different terms for it, secondary radar, number of things like that. But even if your transponder is not working, what's known as a primary target, which is just the echo, just the actual reflected radar beam, that can be picked up as well. And the first thing they started doing when they realized the plane was lost was they started reviewing the air traffic control, what we call the tapes, the data, because the voices are recorded, but also the radar data itself is recorded. And they started noticing that they're a primary target started being displayed on the radar scope, starting at the point where Malaysia 370 had made their last final report, and they were able to track the movement of that primary target. Now, the thing with primary radar is there is no coded identification, but obviously pretty logical. You've lost an airplane, and all of a sudden there's a primary target out there. You can make the assumption that in fact was Malaysia 370. And that's how they were able to track that it came back toward the Malay Peninsula and then initially out toward the southern Indian Ocean.
And I mean, we were surprised to learn that there are areas in the world, mostly over isolated or desolate ocean patches, where a plane is technically not being tracked all the time. Is this true? And if so, why?
It was true in 2014.
Okay.
Not so much true anymore. Now, in 2014, a new system was just coming online in getting wide use within the airlines that used satellite equipment to track aircraft using transmitters on board the aircraft called ADS-B, Automatic Dependent Surveillance Broadcast. It was starting to be used in 2014, but it didn't have wide use. Radar, of course, depends on large antennas that typically can only be mounted on land. And you can have maybe 200 to 300 miles at best of radar coverage out over the water. Now, in the case of this particular route with Malaysia 370, that worked because even though they were over water, they were never far offshore, so they were still able to be in radar contact through much of the flight. Of course, flying from the west coast of California to Hawaii, for example, you're out of radar contact in about 150 miles or so offshore. But ADS-B can take over. That can, using the satellites, can pinpoint an aircraft quite precisely. There was another tragedy that occurred in the South Atlantic. Air France 447, an Airbus A330. It was equipped, I'll get to that in a second. The Airbus was equipped with the most advanced communication equipment. When they ran into their problem and unfortunately crashed into the Atlantic Ocean, they knew within about a half a mile where that aircraft had hit the water. The Malaysia 370 aircraft, going back to 2014, it was one of the original 777s, 777s that Malaysia Airlines had bought, and it didn't have any of that advanced equipment that was available at the time. Certainly legal, certainly safe. There is radio communication that allows the aircraft to be in touch with air traffic control when they're out over the water outside of radar contact, but it doesn't have the data connection that ADS-B affords that allows for precise location of the aircraft.
Gotcha. And what was the Malaysian government's response to this missing plane? Did they withhold any information that they had? And if so, why would they have done that?
Well, that gets into some cultural norms that may not exist in other countries. But the thought in 2014, the thought that an airliner could just disappear was so shattering to the aviation world and also to the country of Malaysia itself, particularly in Asia. The national airlines in Asia are sources of pride for the countries. It's a way of waving the flag overseas, a way of projecting their global or projecting their country's heritage across the globe. And this was a very embarrassing thing for Malaysian Airlines and the government of Malaysia as well. And I believe, in my opinion, that drove a little bit of their reticence in the beginning of the investigation to be as forthcoming as they could. I believe behind the scenes they were. I believe working with the other government agencies, the search and rescue folks, and the folks that were offering the help to, because it was a true international effort to try to find this aircraft. I believe they were probably being much more forthcoming with the governments behind the scenes, but we weren't seeing that in the public sphere.
What can you tell us about the pilots that were flying this plane on that day or that night? How experienced were they, and what was their dynamic?
Yeah, the captain was one of the most senior captains flying for Malaysian Airlines. Had been there over 20 years. A lot of respect. And again, in a lot of countries, particularly in Asia, flying for the national airline is a very respectable job, a very desirable one. And he was a rock star, basically. The first officer that was flying with him was a fairly junior first officer, fairly new to the airline, but he had great background as well. And it appears the dynamic between the two were what you would expect, very professional, but also friendly. I'm sure the captain, with his experience, was trying to impart as much of that as he could to the first officer to help with his mentoring and education. And that's a very normal crew situation that it appears that they had.
Can you explain to us you spoke about this a little bit earlier, but what they believe the flight pattern was for this flight, and in your opinion, what does it tell us about what could have happened?
Well, yeah, everything was perfectly normal. When an airliner is going to fly somewhere, the very first thing that happens is the airline's dispatcher that has responsibility for that flight, among other things, files a flight plan with air traffic control. And that flight plan shows the entire route of flight from takeoff to touchdown, the speeds and the altitude the aircraft intends to fly. And then part of what the crew will do is receive their air traffic control clearance, which in most cases just confirms that same route of flight, but everybody agrees the route of flight the airplane is going to take. And up until that point between Singapore air traffic control and Vietnam air traffic control, the aircraft was quite in compliance with that route. Then all of a sudden the event occurred and the aircraft stopped transmitting the routine voice reports. The transponder was turned off, and we do know that the transponder was turned off. It wasn't like there was a catastrophic failure, and I can get into that if you like, but there's data that shows the transponder was intentionally turned off, and then that's the last we hear of the flight. Then we start having to dig deep and find those primary radar targets and things of that nature.
Yeah, what does that tell, the fact that the transponder was turned off, what does that tell us?
It tells us that human intervention occurred in a very abnormal way, and that this was purposefully done.
Mm.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns, so you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Does any deviation from the flight plan require communication with air traffic control, or are small changes able to be made at the discretion of the pilot?
No, even if we desire to make a small change, maybe to avoid a thunderstorm, or maybe we want to take what we colloquially call a shortcut, because these route of flights that are filed go from waypoint to waypoint, and it may not be a straight line, and we have equipment on board the aircraft that will allow us to navigate great distances in a straight line, so we may ask for a direct routing. But you can't, under when you're under instrument flight rules, which all aircraft airliners operate under instrument flight rules. Even the smallest change, a route of flight, has to be approved by the air traffic controller before you do it.
Wow. Can you walk us through the plane's depressurization process? We understand that it's possible that the masks might have dropped if the plane was at a certain elevation, and how much oxygen would have been or time do the passengers have before oxygen runs out in the plane?
Certainly. So aircraft typically cruise in anywhere from 30,000 feet as high as 41 or 45,000 feet, depending on the aircraft, how long you're flying, things of that nature. And obviously the ambient air pressure at those altitudes aren't nearly enough to sustain life. So the aircraft is, of course, pressurized. Well, we have systems on board, or should that pressurization system fail, or should, for example, there be a breach of the aircraft cabin itself where the pressure could escape, then that's when the oxygen masks will deploy in the cabin. The pilots will put on their oxygen masks, and an emergency descent will be initiated to get the airplane down to an altitude, typically 10,000 feet, if there's no terrain, that will allow people to breathe normally without the oxygen system. And so that descent is only going to take you, depending on the situation that you have, anywhere from maybe 10 to 15 minutes, maybe a little more, a little less, depending on the situation. So the amount of oxygen that's provided for the passengers is enough to sustain through that descent, with the assumption that we're going to get down to an altitude where oxygen is no longer required. It is certainly a possibility. Within the aircraft, you do have the pilots do have the ability, as we refer to it, dumping the cabin pressure, where activating some cockpit controls will allow the air pressure inside the aircraft to escape. One reason we would do that is, for example, if a fire was to break out on board the aircraft, or we were to get some sort of noxious fumes inside the aircraft. Maybe there was another failure in the pressurization system, and that allowed some exhaust fumes, for example, to enter the cabin. We certainly don't want to have that in there, so we have the ability to dump the cabin pressure. If that is done, but the aircraft does not descend, the oxygen will still be available to the passengers, but it's going to run out in 15, 20, 25 minutes or so. However, the flight crew in the cockpit uses a different oxygen system installed in the aircraft than what the passengers are using. And that is enough to sustain two pilots in the cockpit for, you know, an hour and a half or so, one pilot for possibly even more than that, 3 to 4 to 5 hours. Of time.
Wow. Now that it's starting to make a lot of sense. At first, many people thought that the plane had been hijacked, but why have experts ruled this theory out?
Well, I wouldn't say it's ruled out entirely.
Okay, yeah.
Because the biggest thing, that's the two main theories, are that either it was a September 11th style plan, or the pilot, one or both of the pilots initiated this. One or the other. I think those are the only two theories that make any sense here. The thing that's working against the hijack theory, and it's a very big problem, is bluntly, no group has taken responsibility. I don't remember how long it was after September 11th when the events occurred that morning, but as I remember it, by the end of the day, we knew it was Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had taken responsibility for it. It was pretty clear. 10 years this March, no one's taking credit for it. So if a terrorist organization is going to go to this trouble and successfully, you know, even who knows what the plan may have been, but to at least, you know, take this aircraft out of the world, which essentially happened, no one's taking credit for it. That's probably the largest thing working against it being a terrorist hijack situation. The one big thing that points to a terrorist hijack situation is the fact that if the pilots, one of the pilots or both of them, had done this intentionally, typically when a pilot makes this decision, the event happens pretty quickly. There was an Egypt Air flight, and then of course recently we had a German Wings flight where the pilots committed suicide, and they do it fairly quickly. The thing that is really strange about this is the fact that it does appear the aircraft remained airborne until it ran out of fuel. And that was, they had taken extra fuel for the flight, which was a and that's that can be was done that can be done for any number of reasons, to load additional fuel above and beyond what you need for the specific flight for any number of reasons. But in this specific case, that was done as well. I believe from the time it disappeared from air traffic control, they projected they had upwards of 6 to 7 hours of fuel remaining. And that's one reason that they realized the airplane could have ended up in the Southern Indian Ocean. Typically, when a pilot has done this type of tragic event, it's done much, much more quickly than that. And that's what's really strange about this one.
In general, are there protocols in place to identify a pilot in emotional or mental distress, even in the early stages? And who's responsible for carrying that out?
Well, in the United States, airline pilots are required to get the aviation medical examination from an FAA designated aviation medical examiner, depending on age, either every year or every 6 months. And part of that examination is would be questions from the examiner, and there may not be very many right now. Just, you know, how have things been, and giving the applicant a chance to talk about any issues that there may be. We're all familiar with the situation that happened on the Horizon Airlines Alaska flight with a pilot that was going through some emotional and mental disturbances. And the FAA has formed a task group that is looking at mental and emotional health for pilots and see if any changes need to be made in the evaluations here in the United States.
Now, what do you believe happened to the plane and its passenger? Passengers? What is your opinion?
Well, I know I'm pretty clear. It's clear what happened to the airplane. Mm-hmm. It for reasons undetermined at this point, the aircraft was intentionally deviated from its flight planned path. It flew back toward Malaysia and then continued on into the Southern Indian Ocean, pretty far off the Australian coast, ran out of fuel, and went into the water. We know that for two reasons. Number one, the a few bits of wreckage have washed up on the southeastern African coast, and there have been a number of hydrologists and sea state folks that have said that, yeah, if the airplane had gone into that area, that's where we'd expect parts to wash up. And that occurred. Believe it or not, a couple of the pieces that did wash up in the African coast, they were able to analyze the barnacles that were attached to the wreckage itself. And the barnacles told a story of where that part had been by looking at the how it had grown. Apparently with barnacles, there are growth rings, a lot like what you see on trees. So you could get a sense of time with that. And apparently the makeup of the chemical makeup of the barnacle itself told you what the water was like, where the part had come through. And that also helped let it know that that part had started in the Southern Indian Ocean. But there was also the aircraft, even though it didn't have the most advanced digital communication devices like we talked about earlier, there were some routine digital communication devices on the airplane. Those were also intentionally turned off, and we knew that because both Malaysia Airlines and the air traffic control facilities were trying to contact the aircraft using those digital devices. Didn't have any luck. But one device was left on, and there may not have even been the ability to turn that off. And that device was essentially the satellite communication router. I'm simplifying here a little bit. But the all the things that were connected to that satellite router, the in-flight entertainment system, some of the crew communication systems, the satellite phones, all of those things that were connected to that router were turned off. But the router itself still remained powered, it appears. And the Inmarsat satellite company, which is what Malaysian Airlines contracted with to provide that satellite communication, there were a couple of pings that they were tracking, because it was an abnormal situation for that thing to be turned off. And when that occurs, the satellite system is designed to automatically just reach out to the router and say, "Hey, are you still there? We're not talking to you. Is everything okay?" And the router came back from the airplane and said, "Yep, I'm powered, but nothing else."
Wow.
But those pings were tracked. And unfortunately, only one satellite was tracking that ping. And the thing that's unfortunate about that is, with having just one satellite, you can analyze the time it took for that signal to go from the satellite to the airplane back to the satellite. The radio beams travel at a constant speed, happens to be the speed of light, 186,000 miles per second. But because you have that, you have a known speed and you have a known time, now you can calculate a distance. But the problem is, with only one satellite that you're tracking it from, that distance is basically like a sphere that surrounds that. Because when you take a point, and let's say that you have one single point and you're 100 miles away from it, well, that 100 miles, you don't know the direction. It could be anywhere 100 miles from that one point. If you had two satellites, you could resolve it down to two points where those distances intersect. Three satellites would give you a pretty exact position. And by the way, I just explained how GPS works as well. But having said that, they were able to know that, okay, we know this known distance from this one satellite. So that's when they initially came up with an arc of where this airplane must be. And the arc extended all the way up into China and down into the southern Indian Ocean. Well, the southern China was easy. That was land. There was no wrecked aircraft there. So we knew it wasn't there. Had to be down in the southern Indian Ocean. That's how that all came about.
And there was no known communication between the passengers and any loved ones back home. There was not, didn't seem to have been any attempts to communicate either. What do we suspect happened to the passengers?
Well, I guarantee you there were attempts by the passengers, but because all the communication systems that utilize the satellite system had been turned off, they were unable to communicate. I don't know how much internet connectivity that particular aircraft had. It may not have had very much because, as again, it was one of the early aircraft that Malaysian had bought. The aircraft was almost 20 years old. It did have satellite phone available for both the crew and passenger use. If you remember back in the, it was the late 90s through the mid 2000s, U.S. airliners used to have credit card phones on board. That was a very rudimentary satellite system, but the Malaysian aircraft did have that available for the passengers, but that system was turned off. And we know that because folks on the ground were trying to call the aircraft using those systems, didn't have any luck.
I see.
If we talked about the depressurization scenario where, for example, if the pilot had been, or the pilots had been responsible for this, and they basically wanted to put everybody to sleep, that's what would have occurred. In a depressurization scenario where you don't descend the aircraft down, the oxygen masks would automatically deploy, and they would put the oxygen masks on, and they would be awake and conscious and, you know, wonder what's happening. The oxygen would run out 15, 20 minutes. If the air pressure in the airplane, if they were still up at 35,000 feet, people would just eventually go to sleep. depending on the age and fitness of a person, they might be able to, that might be enough. The air pressure might be enough to sustain life for a long time. They wouldn't be conscious, but you'd certainly be able to, people would be able to sustain life at that air pressure for a long time. But even then, it after a while, people aren't going to, it won't be enough to sustain life. And it appears that as long as this aircraft stayed airborne for seven and a half hours, it would have been a very challenging situation for people.
Wow.
So that appears to, in this case, we don't know about the depressurization situation at this point.
Right.
I do like to say when we do find the aircraft wreckage and the flight data recorders, they will be, we'll be able to solve the riddle, essentially. Now, the flight, there are two types of recorders on the aircraft, cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder. The cockpit voice recorder is going to be useless in this case because the cockpit voice recorder on this particular aircraft only records 2 hours of time, and then it's just a constant loop, and there's constantly overriding the last 2 hours. Because the airplane flew for over 7 hours after the event started, who knows what's going to be on there? Probably a whole lot of nothing.
Wow.
However, the flight data recorder traps data for 25 hours before it starts to overwrite. And the amount of data that is trapped will be quite useful. It will, for example, a lot of the cockpit switch positions, like the pressurization controls, that'll all be recorded. So we'll be able to find out what happened with that. If a hijacker took control of the aircraft, we would expect to see a lot of, shall we say, fumbling around with the cockpit controls and the autopilot controls. That will be recorded. If the pilots were responsible for this, you wouldn't see that fumbling. The pilots obviously know how to fly the airplane. And you would see very deliberate and very, you know, without a lot of mistakes being made with what they're trying to do to control the aircraft. So once the flight data recorder is recovered, that a lot of this will unravel and we'll get a lot of answers to all this stuff.
So unfortunately, we're running out of time, but we do like to ask all of our guest experts this question. At the end of the day, if you had to pick a person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the disappearance of Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, who or what would that be?
As much as it hurts me to say this, I do believe the captain or the pilots were responsible. So that brings to the question, what can we do in the future to prevent a pilot that is contemplating this type of activity access to the cockpit? That is going to be a very challenging question for the industry to answer. But unfortunately, it's becoming clear that that's a question we're going to have to take on.
Scott, thank you so much for helping us understand this tragic and haunting disaster.
You bet. My pleasure. Thank you very much.
If you'd like to hear our post-interview discussion and final verdict, head over to Patreon and subscribe. Your support is greatly appreciated. Check out our show notes for a link or head over to patreon.com/thealarmist. And stay tuned because next week we'll be discussing the Kendall Jenner pet.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love and be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays.
Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Commercial. The Alarmist.
Powered by Acast.